All right, we're continuing our study here, the book of Deuteronomy. If you're welcome, we're glad that you're here. Didn't get quite as far as I had planned on getting into last Wednesday, so we'll be starting there with chapter 16. I want to go back and touch on something that I said I'd go back to in talking about those things that they were able to eat and not eat in chapter 14. We looked at the word teeming and that talking about, you know, flying insects and things of that nature. The question came up about locusts, whether or not John the Baptist could eat locusts and those things. But if you want to write out here, Leviticus 11, 20 through 23 talks specifically about four-legged bugs that you were able to eat that fly. Locusts was among them, the various types of locusts. So you're good. For all of those you were worried about that, about changing your diet because you weren't going to be able to eat bugs anymore, that's no longer an issue. So you're good. But those things, it's neat to see those things and see how they play out throughout the rest of the Bible. So it's a good question in talking about John the Baptist. So as we continue looking in chapter 16, we kind of briefly looked into it and talking about the various feasts that are here that are important. And I wanted to bring up what was mentioned before as well, in that the things that we're going through and why he's going over these again in certain contexts is that some of these things, especially some of the feasts, were initially done in one context, but now we're talking about how do they practice them as a nation spread out over different areas and the different cities. What does that look like? Because they're about to go into, and they keep getting reminded, they're about to go into this land that God has given them, and they're no longer going to be camped right next to each other all the time. Their neighbors are going to change, right? They're going to have these different cities and stuff. So what does that look like? You know, where in the past, it might have been a few city blocks to go to the temple or the tabernacle at that time to worship and to do practice these things. Now, they're going to be coming from, you know, a day's travel or more, and all these different directions coming to this place. So some things are going to be changing a little bit. So this is how to practice what God has taught them as a nation under theocracy in kind of a new context for them. And so as they celebrate the Passover, this is mentioned here in chapter 16, in the first few verses. He talks about the bread of affliction in verse 3. You shall not eat unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat with unleavened bread. I'm sorry, you shall not eat leavened. The bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, so that you may remember. And again, there's a lot of these things that are here, and this is a word that we keep seeing over and over again in the book of Deuteronomy, that you will remember these things. Do not forget. And so they came out of the land of Egypt. They came out of bondage. And so there's 7 days you're supposed to eat this. Now, what's interesting about this is you are not allowed to sacrifice a Passover in any of your towns. What do we know? What were they supposed to do with the Passover? Exodus chapter 12 talks about the Passover. What were they supposed to do with the Passover? Do you remember? What were they supposed to kill? A lamb. And what were they supposed to do with the blood? They're not doing that anymore. They have to go to Jerusalem to do the sacrifice there. They cannot do the Passover lamb in their cities. That's changed. That's a change. They have to go to, well, not Jerusalem at this time, but go to wherever the tent is, the tabernacle is. It was at Shiloh for a time. So they have to go to the tabernacle and to do this. So they're not doing that anymore. So you see what I'm saying? Like, the things are changing a little bit for them as they go into these places. How do we continue to do what we practiced together in this group in these certain circumstances, now spread out as a nation? What does that look like? And we talked last week about there were some with offerings, there were some, you know, stipulations made that made it easier for you to travel, but you still had to go, right? Remember, those stipulations were, if you have to bring your offering from so far, sell it all, right? Take the money and then buy that offering there, and then, you know, do your offering there in that way. And so the importance on coming to the place that God has specified when doing these things is important. So that's something that it's interesting. You're not allowed to do the Passover in any of your towns. You have to come to this place. And it still goes over, you shall cook it and eat it in the place where the Lord your God chooses. In the morning you are to return to your tents. And so he acknowledges that they're in tents. But we don't have any instruction here about painting anything. All right, this is now going to be done in a more figurative way at the temple. And so it's practiced in a different way. And so it talks about eating unleavened bread. And it shall be a solemn assembly on the seventh day. And you shall do no work. And then verse 9, we have the Pentecost, or Feast of Weeks, is more commonly known. You shall count 7 weeks for yourself. This you see in Exodus chapter 23, verse 16. The 7 weeks. And you shall celebrate Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering of your land, of your hand, which you shall give, just as the Lord your God blesses you. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter and your male and female servants and the Levite who is within your town, the stranger, the orphan, the widow who is in your midst, in the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name. What's interesting here, this, the Pentecost, what happened if we fast forward a few hundred years, what happens on a certain Pentecost? The church established, we have the first gospel sermon being preached. What's interesting here is that the instruction that everybody comes to the place that God has designated, and everybody comes. Why would it be important that we're coming to a place and we're going to rejoice at this place? And why is it important that everybody would come? That God was making provisions that on that day that he knew would be that day, prepared to be that day, that he made special instructions that everybody come. Why do you think that's important?
Everybody to know.
Everybody gets it. So if they were all obedient to this like they were supposed to, the whole nation would have been there in Jerusalem at the time. Everybody would have been there. And so this concept of the truth going out of Zion first and that kind of thing, and the concept there of rejoicing and knowing that sins are forgiven, of course there's repentance and those kinds of things involved in that, but it's interesting that these statements are made here in connection with this feast, that they should be there and everybody should be there and be there to celebrate. And then in verse 13, you have celebrate the Feast of Booths. Leviticus chapter 23, 33 through 34 talks about this. 7 days after you have gathered in from your threshing floor and your wine vat, you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son, your daughter, and male, and so everybody's going there again. 7 days you shall celebrate the feast, and in the place where the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you. So that's a specific blessing there with this, again, going there. And those 16 through 17 reminds them that 3 times in a year all your males shall appear to the Lord your God in the place he chooses, and that whatever he chose for the tabernacle to be, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Booths. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every male, every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you, this free will offering that they're supposed to bring 3 times a year, every male. So these are things that are supposed to do. And again, more information here about them as a nation and how they're supposed to practice these things together. And then we get into some judgments here about judges, and we're kind of this will bleed over into the next chapter as well. But when you go in and you're going to be a nation again, who was the judge and what was going on as far as judges were concerned and dealing with the people at the time? Do you remember who was supposed to be doing that? Who was the judge at the time? Who was the leader, the one that was making these judgments? Moses was, right. Look over in Exodus chapter 18. Exodus chapter 18, beginning in verse 13. And it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from the morning until evening. And if you're an introvert, that is not a fun thing, right? So there's all these people around you. Now when Moses' father-in-law saw all that was doing the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, and all the people stand and about you from morning until evening?" Now, it's nice when a father-in-law offers advice, right? Most of the time, if you're polite, you smile and nod and say, yes, sir. That's what you're supposed to say. And here Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people came to me to inquire of God, and when they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge. And so he's explaining what he's doing. But what if you read this text, what is Jethro, what does he counsel Moses on doing here? What does he counsel him in going forward? You're not going to be able to do it all, Moses. You're trying to be, you're already 80 plus years old, Moses, right? So what else? He says specifically in verse 17, the thing you're doing isn't good. This isn't great, right? Because they're going to wear you out. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. It is nice for you to have somebody in your life that will tell you, you have too much on your plate. Yes. Do you need that person? That you'll trust to listen to them, and they'll come to you and say, you've got too much. Nothing's getting done because you have too much. And so this is what happens here with Jethro. He tells him, he says, you need to set up other judges and let them bring the big things to you. Let them filter out the small stuff, right? About the fence line or, you know, whatever, those small stuff. You know, their tent peg is over on my property, my side of the line or whatever. Don't let them bring that to you. That is not something you need to do. And so in like manner we have, what is that going to look like? You remember he sets up, you know, judges of hundreds of 20s or 50s and 10s and all that. And so there's this disbursement of authority in order to kind of help weed out those kind of things. And we see this here again. What is that going to look like as a nation on all these different places? And so verse 18, you shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all of your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, shall not be partial. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue. Sounds like a comic book, but that's why justice? Why is justice important? So there's a knowledge of the rules, that's part of it. Why is justice important? Fair, right, that there's, yes, God is just, he wants people to be just. And think about it as a city, this that justice kind of helps get a group of people together to work together. So there's a common, he's outlined here how they're supposed to live. There's a way of enforcing that type of how we're living, and we're going to see that here in just a moment. But everybody, like you're saying, there's a common law and justice, and you know that justice can be served. And when justice is not right, when it is partial, then it breaks down the whole system. And it can be chaos. And so in this case, justice and only justice you shall pursue. We have sort of a break here in this talking of justice in verses 21 through chapter 17, verse 1, and we have some you shall nots. You shall not plant for yourself Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord. And these were probably wooden carved figures, maybe like a totem pole kind of thing, but in connection with those gods that were there before them. And you're not supposed to do this in connection with serving God this way. We see also, you shall not set up for yourself sacred pillars. So this is like a stone kind of structure, like an obelisk of some sort. Where would they have seen obelisks? Egypt, right? They would have seen these kind of structures and these wooden ones when they came into different contacts with different peoples. And so they're not supposed to set those things up. Chapter 17, verse 1, we continue this transition in talking about these things. But you shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord, or any evil, is what literally the translation says, any evil. And so it would be evil for you, it would be testable, to bring to God these things that are already and offer to him anything that was lame. So these are you shall not kind of in between here, and then we get back to our theme of judgment in verse 2, if there is found in your midst. And so we get into a case study here in connection with judgment. If there's in your town, in your midst, and the Lord your God has given you a man or a woman that does what's evil. And we've already seen instruction, right, about if a town starts leading people astray. We've talked about what it is in instructions if an individual leads people astray, or if somebody starts leading people astray, somebody you like, or even if a whole town starts operating outside the norms that God has prescribed, it's to be just razed to the ground, right, and just destroyed and forgotten. But now we're dealing with a man or a woman does what's evil in the sight of the Lord by transgressing his covenant. And it's not, in this case they say, and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or talks about the sun or moon or heavenly hosts, which I have not commanded, which in saying this, when God says, which I have not commanded, that is to say, we are to worship in the confines of where God has commanded. And this verse says that silence is not permissible. When God has commanded a thing, I want to be worshiped in this way. This verse says, where I have not commanded, if they're worshiping any way that I have not commanded, he is outright saying that you can't say, on the other hand, well, God didn't say we couldn't do this. Have you heard children do that? You didn't say I couldn't get candy when I went to get the milk from the store. You didn't say I couldn't. But God is shutting that down here with this verse. He's saying, I've spoken on a thing, and if you're doing something I have not commanded, it is outside parameters. That is outside of what is acceptable if you're doing those things. And so this is a great verse here as far as an argument from silence. This also comes up in Hebrews chapter 7. When the writer of Hebrews talks about Jesus being from the tribe that God spoke nothing about concerning a priest. That's an argument from silence. God did not say anything about those. So this comes up in other places as well. And so it's a good verse, a good thought to have whenever we talk about silence in God's mind is not permissive. It's not permissive. And so if it is told you and you have heard of it, this transgression in verse 4 that they've done, then you shall inquire thoroughly. Why is it important if you hear a thing that maybe you dig more deeply into a thing? Why is that important? What's that? Validating that it's actually accurate. Have you ever heard something and it was wrong? I remember one time I was in Sevierville, Tennessee. I was eating dinner by myself. I was out when I was raising funds getting to Paraguay, and I heard some people in another booth saying that they heard that Dolly Parton died. Now, we've all been waiting for it for a while, right? She can't, I mean, how old is she really? So I'm like, well, Dolly Parton died. That's, you know, that's it. So I texted somebody, I heard Dolly Parton died, right? And then guess what? She didn't die. But I heard it. I didn't verify it. This is before you could really Google much, but you understand what I'm saying? So it's important to verify. And especially when it comes down to these, what are the stakes here with these things that we're talking about? What are the stakes? What are the stakes? Are the stakes high? It's life and death, right? And you never, never mind. Mess with the Sicilian. Okay, so life and death situation right here in connection with these things. So it's very important that they would inquire thoroughly and make sure this is true. That's certain that this happened. And then you bring this man or woman to your gates and you judge them. And then if you've judged them accurately, you take them outside the city and you stone them to death. And the evidence, on the evidence of two or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Verse 7, the hand of the witness shall be first against him. How does that help keep things kind of above bar? That if you are going to be a witness against somebody, you're going to throw the first stone. You're going to throw the first stone. Yes. So false accusations, anonymous notes, right? That's what this is trying to, that doesn't work. If you're going to be a witness against somebody, you cannot do it anonymously. What's that? We know they weren't, right? They weren't with Jesus. Right? That was a pretty public thing. Right? They would trump up, you know, they had unscrupulous men, the text tells us, that were there to be false witnesses against Jesus. So I'm sure Jesus wasn't the first time. If that was their go-to game, then I'm sure they had it practiced, right? I'm sure it wasn't always above bar. But again, still, this is a situation where Rome had taken that away from them. Because in the case of Jesus, they weren't going to be throwing stones at Jesus. They could just stand up and say this, but they weren't going to be throwing stones because it would be the Romans that were going to be crucifying Christ. And so that kind of stipulation got taken away from them in that stance. But afterward, the hand of all the people, so you shall purge the evil from your midst. And so you took an active part in your town, in your little pueblito. Like you took a part. If somebody was doing something that was wrong, you played a part in getting rid of them. It was that serious. This was a town event when this happened. God was very, very serious, and he wanted you to see it. He wanted us to see it so we'd know how serious it was. What's that? Yes, yes, it can. Death and life in the power of the tongue, right? And so we got to be very careful about that. And in verse 8, it talks about instances that are too difficult. And this kind of goes back to what Moses was doing, and that the judgments were taken to him if they were very difficult. And he says here that if it's too difficult, you're supposed to go, and this needs to be decided at the tabernacle. And there will be Levitical priests or the judge who is in office in those days, verse 9, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. Now, this was not an appeals court. This was not an appeals court. If you didn't like the judgment that happened in that town, you could not now go to, well, I don't like this judgment. I'm going to go to the tabernacle and see if I can get a separate judgment, another ruling on this. That's not what this is. The town judge would, this when he hears the case, let's just use those kind of words, when he hears the case, and if for him, he said, this is too much. This is too much for me. I don't want to decide this. Maybe it'd be difficult for him to be impartial or something like that. He would then send it on, and they would go to the tabernacle. All right, so this was not an appeals process. This was just sending it up the chain. And then we have to go this. And he says here in verse 10, you shall be careful to observe according to what they teach you, all that they teach you. And so there's a learning process in this. Verse 11, according to the terms of the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do. And you shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you to the right or to the left. Are you hearing the power of the judgment here? Where else do we see this type of language in the Bible? Not turning to the left or to the right concerning what? The Word of God, right? The Word of God. And so there's when they're using the law, they're using this verdict, do not deviate from whatever judgment they give you. And so this is from the judge or the high priest, the priests that are there at that time. Now, verse 12 talks about the one who is presumptuous by not listening to the priest or the judge. If they don't listen to him, guess what they're getting? What's happening to them according to verse 12? Yes, what's happening. My text says purged, right? It's a nicer. They get purged, which we all know what that means. Wink, wink, right? So yes. Look at verse 13. Why is justice important? Why is it important that those who commit a crime receive a swift punishment? Why is that important, according to verse 13? Yes, so people can see, so they won't do it. And the text tells us that the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again. Injustice should be swift. It should be exacting, and it should be obviously according to the crime here. And this helps keep everybody where they're supposed to be. I'm not going to go down the path of commenting on our current scenario, but you understand what I'm saying. There are a lot of deterrents from those kind of things. All right, we're getting into this latter part here of chapter 17 with a king. A king, you say? Yes, a king. When you enter the land which the Lord God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like the nations round about me. Does this sound familiar? It does. I mean, this gets played out later on. And if you want to write out here, God makes provision because he knows they're going to ask for this in the future. God makes provision. God has made provision for authorities, for rulers and those in authority. He's made provisions for them. Romans chapter 13 talks about how they are used in judgment, in connection with judgment, and here it is being used in the case where he makes this a situation where they will eventually ask for a king. If you ask for a king, this is what's going to happen. But who is supposed to choose the king? According to verse 15. Who chooses the king? God does. God chooses a king. Well, they can't just pick any old person. You look kingly, we'll make you a king. No, there's supposed to be a certain person. God choosing that. And the king, there's instructions here. The king, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return again. 17, he shall not multiply wives for himself. If you want to write it here, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1. Let's have a big cavalry, like a big army, like multiply horses. That's like saying you're not supposed to have a bunch of Humvees and tanks. Right? We don't want you multiplying your military might. he's not saying you can't have a stable, right? If you wanted to have a few racehorses or something like that. But what he's saying is, like, you can't be multiplying these horses for war is the idea. Multiplying, what does he say here? Wives in 17, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1. And nor shall he greatly increase silver or gold for himself. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 14. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 14. Who might have broken some of these? Solomon kind of. Did he just tiptoe over the line on these things? Just like, I just grazed. No, he went like way over the line on these things, right? So, yeah. So this is the instruction about what a king shall not do. Now, what is a king supposed to do? And we're getting in verse 18. What is a king supposed to do? What's nice when God does this kind of, you shall not do these things, but this is what you're supposed to do. And you see how they're like separate from one another. And he gives us that here with the king. What's a king supposed to do? He's supposed to copy his own copy of the law. With the Levites there, making sure he gets every jot and every tittle, right? Making sure he knows it. Now, why is it important that a leader of the nation knows God's commandment on how to lead a nation? He wants God, he wants them to do the whole thing. What else? I heard some over here. To have a godly nation. Like, things come down from the king, and if the king's mind or his ideas of how to lead are off, then what happens to the nation? The nation goes awry, and so he needs to make sure that these things are being taught and that they're in the presence of the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God. The language here kind of gives us the idea that he's going around, any free time, any downtime he has, he's copying it, and once it's done, it's under his arm everywhere he goes. Or maybe he has people carry it for him, but you get the idea. Like, it should be that close to him everywhere he goes. That's how important it is. by carefully observing some of the words, verse 19, all of the words, all of them, all the words and these statutes, so his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, and that he might, that he and his sons might continue long in his kingdom. Now, you know the story of Saul. Was Saul the example of somebody that did what was right in the eyes of the Lord? Messed up, right? He messed up. Did his son Jonathan continue that lineage of kingship? No, he did not. David was, again, you know, appointed. But we see here this idea that these are the things that they're supposed to be doing. This is what a king is supposed to do. If you want to write out here, I didn't write out here. I didn't write it in my notes. But going over 1 Samuel, let's go over real quickly. Where are we on time? Chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8, Israel demands a king. They're going to do it. Behold, you've grown old, and your sons, verse 5 of chapter 8, do not walk in your ways. They're not just. His sons were not just. So this is another reason why, if you have just judges, people are more inclined to kind of work with them. But when they're not just, people want to rebel. And so they say to the king, Samuel, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard that they will say, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Do you see where God put himself with the people? God was supposed to be their king. He made provisions that they would, because he knew eventually they were going to ask for these things, to be like those around them. And so he said, let them do this. Now what does Samuel do here in verse 10? Beginning of verse 10 through the verse 18, what does he say about kings? He says, all right, you want to ask for a king, they're going to be amazing. Kings are the best. Kings are never going to tax you. They're never going to put your sons and daughter in harm's way. They're going to be the best. It'll be the best. Is that what he says about kings? No. He basically gives them, here's what a king, all right, you want a king. If you want a king, here's all the horrible things a king could possibly or will do to you if you ask for a king. Exactly. Not always greener, right? Be careful what you wish for. And then you will cry out on that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. This is a biblical, don't come crying to me if what I said comes true. Don't come crying to me. But they did it anyway. They refused to listen. A lot of life lessons when we refuse to listen here. And they refused to listen. And they got exactly what was going to happen. And so now in chapter 18, we get into a portion of the Levites and talking about what is for them. Yes, sir.
Makes that comment and reads it every day.
Yeah.
I don't believe he read the Bible that day.
Yes. Are you hearing what he's saying? If Solomon was reading the Bible the whole time, he wouldn't have married maybe all those people. But
I read it every day.
Yeah. So if God is saying kings are to read the Bible every day, would it be a good idea for us to be reading the Bible every day maybe? Yeah. Just throwing it out there. See if it sticks. So, do I have five more? Okay. The sound check, all three said yes. Okay. Levitical priests and the whole tribe of Levi, they have their portion. And this has been covered before, but it's covered again. Verse 2, as he promised, as the Lord promised, this is going to be the inheritance. They have no land. And so this is, again, something that they're supposed to be taking. Verse 3 tells them specifically the pieces that they get from the sacrifices, the shoulder, the two cheeks, these, and the stomach, the fourth stomach of the cow. If you have not had cow cheeks, it is good. Let me tell you, it's a choice piece. It's really, really, anyway, it's good. You may have to go to like El Presidente or someplace like that to get the cow cheeks, but it's good. These cheeks, It's getting, yep, that's a different name. So that's the fourth stomach of the stomachs. So they also first fruits here. Numbers 18, verse 12. This was extensively covered in Numbers chapter 18. I think you guys all remember all that. You know, we had this extensively covered there. And you shall serve, and they shall stand to serve in the name of the Lord forever. That's the idea here. In the name of the Lord, in the name, if you're standing in the name of somebody, who, what does that mean? You're representing. What's that? You're representing God. You're standing on behalf of His authority, right? That's been given to you by God. What's that? You're following God. Do we do anything in the name of anybody anymore? John 14, 14. Do we ask? Whenever you ask, ask in my name. Jesus' name, Jesus saying that. Jesus, the red letters. You didn't see Him come out. There were red letters that were coming out of my mouth. By the authority of. That's interesting that you serve in the name of the Lord forever. And so He gives them that information. And He shall serve in the name of the Lord, again, verse 7. And they shall eat equal portions, except what they receive from the sale of their father's estates. Right out here, next to verse 8, Leviticus chapter 25, 33 and 34. They could sell houses. They would get them back in the year of Jubilee. They would get them back. They could sell houses, but they could not sell their pasture lands. Those are things they could not sell because they had just, you know, just a few hundred yards outside their cities that they were given. So they couldn't sell that. Leviticus chapter 25, verses 33 to 34. So this is not talking about selling pasture land. This is about houses or something of that nature. And then we have some information here about the spirits. That's why not spirits, but those who, the detestable things that he talks about that the other nations did, about making your sons or daughters pass through the fire, verse 10, witchcraft, interprets omens, sorcerers, cast spells, mediums, spiritualists, one who calls up the dead. These things are right out. These have already been talked about in Leviticus and Numbers already, but he goes over them again. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord, because these detestable things the Lord your God will drive out them out before you. So these are the practices. He wants them to be blameless, verse 13. But as for you, the Lord God has not allowed you to do this. Don't do it. In verse 15 of chapter 8, we get into this again, talking about the prophet. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your countrymen. You shall listen to him. I think we're going to stop there for tonight. Any questions, comments? You guys are going to go out and try and find cow cheeks. I promise. It's really good. You are dismissed. Thank you very much.